From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, as Ukraine signs an historic free trade deal with the EU, Russia hits back, warning Kiev of grave economic consequences.
Absolutely sure that Ukrainian association agreement with the European Union is not just to finish our seven-year process, but the launch of the process for modernization of my country.
Also today, after years of research, London scientists celebrate a major breakthrough in tackling malaria, and the 20,000 Team USA fans cheering for World Cup glory in Germany.
So next time we're going to match up against Germany, it's going to be in the final US-Germany final World Cup 2014, but this time the US is going to come out on top.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. On the sidelines of a two-day summit in Brussels, the European Union has signed significant trade and political agreements with Ukraine, Georgia, and Moldova. The move has not been well received by neighboring Russia. The accord, which was originally thrown out by Ukraine's former pro-Russian president, set the wheels in motion that led to Russia's annexation of Crimea, and months of instability has followed. Moscow has warned it could scale back trade ties with the former Soviet republics as a result of the pact. Our correspondent in Moscow, Natalie Powell, reports.
The pact is being seen as a landmark agreement drawing all three countries closer to the European Union, but it's a commitment that has angered Moscow. It says the deal would damage Russia economically by rupturing trade ties. Russia has threatened to scale back exports and tighten its borders both to trade and to immigration. The EU, however, argues that these deals will not prevent the states from seeking close economic and political relations with Russia. Instead, the pact is designed to transform the countries into stable and prosperous democracies.
Additionally, the EU summit is set to confirm former Luxembourg Prime Minister Jean-Claude Juncker as the next president of the European Commission, despite British opposition. UK Prime Minister David Cameron says Mr. Juncker will block reform of the EU voted for by millions of Europeans in recent elections. But several British allies on the matter have changed tack and say they will now support Mr. Juncker's appointment. Sandra Gatman is at the summit in Brussels. She says David Cameron has run out of support.
He seems to be isolated in his campaign against the former Luxembourgish prime minister and many of his fellow colleagues, the Dutch prime minister Mark Rutte, Sweden's Reinfeldt, even German Chancellor Angela Merkel have all appeared slightly flaky on their support for Mr. Juncker. But it now appears that when it comes down to it, and Mr. Cameron is forced perhaps to take a vote on this, that they will all support Juncker.
The first American armed drones have begun flying above the Iraqi skies, but U.S. officials say it could take several weeks of aerial surveillance and intelligence analysis before they begin striking militant targets in Iraq. Washington correspondent Daniel Wrenches reports.
The first contingent of U.S. forces has begun the process of gathering data on the movements and capabilities of the Iraqi militant group known as ISIS. 300 deployed personnel in Baghdad are working from a joint operations center with Iraqi forces. A U.S. aircraft carrier and several other warships are also in the Gulf. U.S. officials say the 30 to 35 manned surveillance planes and drone aircraft will help them, over several weeks, build up a full picture of the militant group's activities and weapons stockpile.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The Obama administration has announced it will take steps to join the treaty banning landmines. More than 160 countries have signed on since 1999, but the U.S. has resisted joining, despite being the largest donor to landmine removal efforts. Priscilla Huff has more.
The Obama administration has announced it is diligently pursuing steps to get rid of its estimated stockpile of 10 million anti-personnel mines. The goal is to eventually join the United Nations Anti-Personnel Mine Ban Convention, often called the Ottawa Convention. The treaty was first agreed to 15 years ago, with 160 countries joining. But major powers, including China, Russia, and Iran, are not signatories. Campaigners are not entirely satisfied with the announcement, saying the U.S. should set a date to join the mine ban treaty and start to destroy its stockpile.
Facebook has revealed details of a U.S. court order forcing it to hand over the data of almost 400 users. The unprecedented request demanded the social media site give up photos, private messages, and other information as part of an investigation into disability benefit fraud. Rebecca Bowering reports from San Francisco.
The social network says the request was by far the largest it's ever received from a government body. The sweeping search warrants were issued by a court in New York last summer. Facebook argued they were unconstitutional, but its appeal failed. Facebook says the government obtained gag orders which banned it from discussing the case until a fresh appeal made it public. 381 people were accused of fraudulently claiming disability benefits when their Facebook accounts showed they were, in fact, healthy. 62 were later charged. Facebook was defined as a digital landlord in the case, meaning it had to comply with search warrants.
For the rest of today's news, you can follow us on Twitter at Feature Story. And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. European Union leaders have given pro-Russian forces in Ukraine a Monday deadline to retreat from East Ukrainian checkpoints and return hostages from an international monitoring team. The ultimatum was handed down just as political and trade deals were signed between the EU and former Soviet republics Ukraine, Georgia and Moldova. Our correspondent Sandra Gatman reports.
In the presence of all 28 leaders of the European Union gathered around a table, three former Soviet republics, Ukraine, Georgia and Moldova, signed association agreements with the EU. In a ceremony, Ukraine's president, Petro Poroshenko, described as historic.
I think this is the most important day for Ukrainian history after Independence Day. I'm absolutely sure that Ukrainian association agreement with the European Union is not just to finish our seven-year process, but the launch of the process for modernization of my country.
The deals provide a roadmap for countries aspiring to eventually join the EU, agreeing to political and economic reforms. A separate deal will also see the lifting of trade barriers. But for Ukraine, this was a symbolic victory. Former President Viktor Yanukovych U-turned on the same deal last year in favor of forging closer ties with Russia, sparking pro-EU revolutions in the capital Kiev that led to his overthrow. The subsequent pro-Russian rebel movements that led to Russia's annexation of the Crimean Peninsula have fueled Western opposition to Moscow's military presence and support from across the border. EU leaders have now given Russia a 72-hour deadline to urge rebels to return border checkpoints, hand over hostages, and stick to a peace plan with Ukraine. European Council President Herman Van Rompuy.
We urge the Russian Federation to actively use its influence. The Council will assess the situation and, should it be required, adopt the necessary decisions. The European Council leaders are committed to reconvene at any time for further significant restrictive measures.
The EU is echoing warnings from the United States that Russia could face economic sanctions. But Amanda Paul, foreign policy expert at the European Policy Center, says reaching a consensus to get tough will prove difficult for Europe.
Clearly, there are some countries that do not support it. I mean, we've seen President Putin in Austria a couple of days ago, looking very happy, both with the Austrians and President Putin. This doesn't give the right message. And of course, there's, you know, question marks from other member states as well, who are very concerned about their economies, which are just starting to have slow signs of growth back. So it's a tricky situation from the EU.
Friday's summit also sought to end tension within the group of EU leaders over the nomination of Jean-Claude Juncker as the European Commission's next president. The UK, together with Hungary, were outvoted 26-2 in supporting the former Luxembourgish prime minister to hold Europe's highest position. Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron feels Mr. Juncker is an old-fashioned federalist and will hurt Britain's chances of staying in Europe if there is a referendum.
I believe Britain's national interest lies in reforming the EU, holding a referendum about that reform in the EU, and recommending that we stay in a reformed European Union. Has that got harder to achieve? Yes.
EU leaders also began mapping their visions for Europe for the next few years. The UK and France agree Europe should be able to move at different speeds, But with economic recovery still fragile and a banking union in the works, many suspect the quest for deeper European integration will continue to cause rifts, especially with new Eastern countries looking to join the club. Sandra Gatman, Brussels.
So, while, as we heard from Sandra Gatman in Brussels, Ukraine's new president was celebrating today's EU deal, the pact drew condemnation and even threats from Russia. I caught up with our correspondent Natalie Powell in Moscow and began by asking her just how the Kremlin had reacted to the news and what consequences were being lined up for Ukraine.
We've heard from Russia's President Vladimir Putin said that making the Ukraine choose between the EU and Russia would essentially split the Ukraine in two. And we've seen over the past few months just how divided the country already is in certain eastern areas. It does really come as no surprise, though, that Moscow is rather upset about the signing of these deals. It's made no secret of the fact and has spoken out about them for a rather long time now. But so far, we've got no firm grasp on what these consequences are going to be. What we do know, though, is what they could potentially look like, as Russia has previously sent a number of warnings about what it would have to do in order to, as it says, protect its own interests. Now, Russia believes that these trade deals could have some serious consequences for its economy, even though the EU has said that this deal would not stop any of these countries, that's Moldova, Ukraine and Georgia, seeking close economic and political ties with Russia. Now, Moscow has threatened to impose trade bans on the three countries signing these association deals and said that it would do so without seeking permission from Belarus or Kazakhstan, its custom union partners. The reason for that is that they could then potentially re-export Ukrainian goods to Russia, and that would be duty-free. Now, this re-exporting is also an issue when it comes to the Ukraine, and one of the reasons that Russia says that it's concerned, it believes that the Ukraine would be able to re-export EU goods to Russia again without those customs duties, and that what that would mean is that Russia would really be losing out. There are concerns, of course, that Russia could not only close its borders to trade, but also close its borders to people. It has warned that it would tighten immigration, and there are hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians, Moldovans and Georgians who work in Russia and rely on Russia for their work. So, although we've no indication yet of what Russia may do, there are a number of different things that it could do in order to, as it says, protect its own interest. And we realise that those number of things would ultimately cause damage to the Ukraine.
Natalie, can you remind us what part today's trade pact originally played in the Ukrainian revolution and the unrest that followed and obviously continues today?
Well, this trade deal has really been at the heart of this conflict between Kiev and Moscow for rather some time now. It even dates back to last year when the former Ukrainian president, who was backed by Russia, Viktor Yanukovych, rejected this same deal in a bid to really move closer to Russia. And it's thought that he was also under some pressure from Russia. Now, that decision led to his ousting by the Ukrainian people, who wanted closer cooperation with Europe. And that set the wheels in motion, leading to Russia's annexation of Crimea. Now, for the past 2 months, the country, Ukraine, has been split, and there's been a great deal of bloodshed in eastern areas between the Ukrainian government forces and pro-Russian separatists that are currently observing a ceasefire.
And Natalie, what is Russia's position on that ceasefire?
Well, the ceasefire has now been extended, we're told, for 72 hours to try to help bring negotiations to the table from both sides. Russia's stance on the current ceasefire is very much in favour of it. President Putin has spoken out, urging Ukraine to extend the ceasefire. Now, Putin has been under quite a great deal of pressure, really, with the EU threatening further sanctions against it, and this third round of sort of stepped-up sanctions. So far, those haven't been imposed. They were talked about at this two-day EU summit. So perhaps he is doing enough at the moment to satisfy the EU, that he's doing what he can to help essentially try to put an end to the turmoil in Ukraine.
FSN's Natalie Powell in Moscow. This is FSN Reports.
Yeah, we were in what's called the group of death. We were in the toughest grouping, and you know, we got through. And so we just still got a chance to win the World Cup.
President Barack Obama, after he reportedly watched the World Cup game aboard Air Force One. As America's embrace of the beautiful game continues, Germany's love affair with soccer is well established. A fact that won't be lost on the 20,000 Americans who are currently living and working in the country's capital, Berlin. But where do these Team USA fanatics congregate to watch their fellow Americans compete for World Cup glory? Our Berlin correspondent Iris Spitzer has been finding out.
People singing the American national anthem at a German bar during the World Cup? For Sheldon Eisenhower from Nebraska, an American living in Berlin who showed up decked out in the stars and stripes, what could be better?
It's great, you know, everybody's usually very accepting about whoever you're voting for. It's a lot of fun, and I can get away dressed like this and I have a great time.
Like the country it's named after, the Berlin restaurant, the Swiss Chalet, remains decidedly neutral when it comes to its soccer viewers. While the majority of people are still German, a large number of Americans have planted their flag here during this year's tournament.
All the Americans I know are coming out to watch the USA hopefully beat, but if not beat, definitely give Germany a real run for their money.
When she's not cheering on the US, Gwendolyn Lynch's chapter of Democrats Abroad Germany registers American voters living in Berlin, and she helped organize this event. But today, it's all about the foosball.
I'm happily surprised at how well we've been doing throughout this Cup. We've been playing fair, we've been giving it our all, we've been using the American spirit.
That spirit, however, wasn't enough to stop Germany's Thomas Müller from scoring in the second half. The Americans struggled in vain to equalize, only to fall by a score of 1-0. Luckily for the Americans, though, Portugal was beating Ghana at the same time, sending the U.S. through to the next round anyway. After the game, Nicholas Beshear from Washington State displayed some of that famous American optimism.
So next time we're going to match up against Germany, it's going to be in the final U.S.-Germany final World Cup 2014, but this time the U.S. is going to come out on top.
But for today, it was the German hosts who got to light their victory cigars. While the loss certainly wasn't the result that the American fans here were hoping to see, they'll happily take their ticket out of the group of death and into the next round. Iris Spitzer, Berlin.
This is FSN Reports. Scientists at Imperial College London are celebrating a breakthrough in a new approach to tackling malaria after 8 years of research. For the first time ever, researchers have managed to genetically engineer mosquitoes so that when they breed, there's a strong bias to producing males in their offspring. In test cases, the mosquito population died out after 5 or 6 generations because of the lack of females. It's the female that carries the malaria parasite, and while this research is in the early stages, it's been widely welcomed. From London, Catherine Drew reports.
Researchers in laboratories at Imperial College London use a special suction device to suck up mosquitoes and examine them. They're the flies that people usually swat away, but these mosquitoes might be the most precious in the world, and they are looked after day and night. They have been genetically modified to produce male-only offspring. Dr. Nikolai Wimbickler is the joint lead researcher on the project.
So the idea is that if you release such a mosquito strain that carries this gene that induces this elimination of the X chromosome into a population, at the population level, the sex ratio will be shifted more and more towards males. So there will be more and more males in the populations and fewer females. But since females are really important for the reproductive output of a population, at some point there are no females left and the population disappears.
This breakthrough is the culmination of 8 years of work. It took scientists 6 years to overcome the problem of infertility in the genetically modified mosquitoes. Professor Andreas Crisante oversaw the research at Imperial College and explains how this technique offers a unique opportunity to fight malaria.
The short-term benefit is you increase the number of males towards the female, and the male do not transmit malaria. So you reduce the number of mosquitoes that transmit the disease. And then you eventually reach a point in which you have a population crash because there are not any more enough female to sustain the reproduction. At this point, you block transmission of malaria. At this point, if you treat all the cases, you don't have malaria anymore, even if the mosquito reappeared.
Malaria kills hundreds of thousands of people each year, mostly young children. 90% of those deaths are in sub-Saharan Africa, and the disease is estimated to cost African economies billions of dollars each year. This preventable and easily treated disease remains a killer in many parts of Africa due to a lack of infrastructure, funds, and sometimes education. The London scientists are working with communities in Kenya, Uganda, and Burkina Faso to prepare for testing to see what happens when the genetically modified mosquitoes are released in the wild. They hope field tests could be carried out in the next 2 to 3 years, depending on how their research is received by the authorities and residents at these sites. Professor Andreas Crisanti says while some may fear this high-tech tampering with nature, this approach will not harm existing ecosystems.
Our technology is tuned to attack only 4 or 5 species. So all the other mosquito species will remain unaffected. This is much milder. What will happen, for example, for spraying a rice field or for spraying open spraying of insecticides, which happens very often.
Campaign groups like Malaria No More UK have welcomed the research as a promising development. Anne-Marie Mayer is a spokesperson for the group.
All the tools we have today are critically important, and the new tools on the horizon. So this is something that could be really exciting. It is early days, but anything that will reduce mosquito populations and malaria-carrying mosquito populations significantly could prove a real advantage.
While testing this development in the wild is some way off, the scientists in London are honing their research and keeping watch over their precious mosquitoes. Catherine Drew, London.
And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight. And with today's edition, Simon Marks.
On FSN Spotlight today, whatever became of Poland? Back in the 1980s, the US engaged in enormous amounts of public diplomacy aimed at winning hearts and minds in Poland. And after the Solidarity Union movement triumphed and the USSR collapsed, the country secured NATO membership in 1999 and joined the European Union 5 years after that. So what's the current state of the Polish state? It's a question The Economist asks in a special report in this weekend's edition of the newspaper. It's written by Wendelin von Bredow, Europe correspondent for The Economist, talking here with the paper's Europe editor, John Peet.
Poland has done unusually well over the last 10 years, especially since it joined the EU. Its GDP has grown on average by 4%, and it even managed to avoid a recession after the financial crisis in 2008, when nearly all the other European countries had a recession. Poland continued to grow.
And does this mean it's playing a sort of more important role generally, particularly in its relations with its two big neighbours, Germany and Russia?
Yes, Poland has become one of the big six in the EU, alongside big countries like Germany, France, Italy, Spain. Poland is the sixth one. And it has gained respect because of its economic performance. It has started to play a more important role politically.
And they talk a little bit about the Weimar Triangle in the European Union, which is Germany, France and Poland. Do you think that is a sort of grouping that carries some particular weight now?
It's a loose grouping, and it has carried some weight during the Ukraine crisis. So the German foreign minister, the French foreign minister, and Radek Sikorski, the Polish foreign minister, went together to Kiev to try and get Viktor Yanukovych, the now deposed president, to sign the association agreement with the EU. That failed, but it was a very visible initiative. Whether the Weimar Triangle will continue to play an important role remains to be seen. I think it's something which people want in theory, but in practice, the German-French relationship is very close, the German-Polish relationship is very close, but actually the Polish-French relationship is always a bit artificial and not really close by nature.
And you suggest, or there have been suggestions, that Radek Sikorski, the foreign minister, might become the foreign representative of the European Union. Do you think that this is quite a likely outcome?
I think it is not unlikely. In particular, he's very qualified. I think he's very keen. And his government is backing him. So they want him to have a prominent role in Brussels and possibly be Kathy Ashton's successor.
Okay, this question of balancing Germany and Russia, though, is quite a difficult one. I mean, historically, they've both been enemies of Poland at different times. And, of course, now Russia is being a bit belligerent. Germany tends to be a bit soft on Russia. Is that causing a sort of tension between Poland and Germany?
Yes, historically the two countries have been invaders. Poland was always in the unfortunate position to be between these big powers that tended to invade Poland. Now, over the last about 5-6 years, its relationship with Germany has massively improved and has become very close, partly because Merkel and Tusk get along well, partly economic relations are very close. I mean, there are lots of really positive developments. But now, in the course of the Ukraine crisis, disagreements have become more visible. Germany is always in favor of appeasing the Russians. They depend on Russian gas. Merkel wants to get on with Putin and doesn't want very strong sanctions against the Russians. The Poles, on the other hand, were, with the Baltic states, advocates of very strong and very immediate sanctions against Russia after the annexation of Crimea.
One very sort of special feature of Poland is the very strong role of the Catholic Church, and this has played a role, obviously, through the first Polish Pope, John Paul II. How strong is the Catholic Church, and what impact does that have on Polish society?
It used to be very strong. Under communism, the church played a very important role. It was a very broad church. It was very inclusive. And it was an island of freedom during communism, where people, playwrights, performed their plays, artists came, and there was a lot of dialogue. That has changed. The Catholic Church is still very important and plays to some extent in a political role, but it has become closed and quite conservative. The clergy's become more conservative in the past, and that is something which, in particular, younger Poles find quite difficult to deal with.
And looking ahead, the Poles face, I think, presidential and parliamentary elections next year. What are the sort of big challenges that you think there are for Poland in the future?
They face local elections in autumn and then presidential and parliamentary elections next year. So there's a whole series of really important elections coming up. There are many challenges, but probably the most important challenges are demography. Poles are not having enough children, and Poles continue to emigrate. So the population is dwindling and aging. So Poles need to be encouraged to stay with the right economic policies. At the end of communism, Poland had 158,000 civil servants. Today it's 460,000. And just under Tusk alone, it has increased by 70,000. That's not good, and that's something that needs to change. A third challenge is to avoid the middle income trap. Poland shouldn't get stuck at its current level of income. And for that, Polish companies need to invest more, and in particular in research and development.
That's Wendelin von Bredow, Europe correspondent for The Economist, talking there about her special report, Poland's Successes. You can read it in the June 28th edition of the paper or find it online at economist.com. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Friday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the programme by emailing us reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Monday, the Supreme Court decision on the highly anticipated Hobby Lobby case on the affordable healthcare birth control rule. That's Monday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.